The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will be reading from Good Old Days magazine. With some Thanksgiving celebrations taking place this month, I wanted to share some Thanksgiving stories with you. And the first story is from the Bits and Pieces section, and it is submitted by Betty Swisher. And it's titled Thanksgiving in Albuquerque. The year was 1953. My husband Chuck was in the U.S. Army stationed in Sandia Air Force Base in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Along with other young couples, we had living quarters off the base called row houses. Each row house consisted of one large room that served as the kitchen and living room. There was also a small bedroom with a connecting bathroom. The floors were linoleum. Sand and dust blew in the houses through the unsealed windows and spaces under the doors. That autumn would be the first time Chuck and I were away from our family members at Thanksgiving. But much to our delight, several other Army couples we met at the row houses wanted to celebrate Thanksgiving with us. One couple from Brooklyn volunteered to furnish the turkey. I've heard of a new way to roast a turkey. Carolyn eagerly volunteered. You put the turkey in a brown paper bag and roast it in a slow oven, she continued. From all I've heard, this paper bag method is the only way to roast a turkey. There were three couples besides Chuck and me who brought food for Thanksgiving dinner. When it was time to take the turkey out of the oven, all of us hovered around Carolyn to see what the turkey would look like. Most of us had doubts and believed the traditional way to roast a turkey was the best and only way. The large turkey had barely fit in the small oven. The allotted time Carolyn projected for roasting the turkey must have been the right time. When she pulled the roasting pan and turkey out from the oven, steam flowed from the pan and the aroma made our senses sharp. The rest of the food was placed on the small dining table. We sat side by side at the table. Strangers at first, we, from different far-off corners of our United States, gathered together to share this Thanksgiving dinner. It was a brown paper bag turkey feast. I will never forget that Thanksgiving dinner are the people who shared it with us. And the next story I want to share with you is submitted by Sarah Etkin Baker, and it's titled, Having Enough. I awoke to the familiar sound of dishes rattling in Mother's kitchen and to the thick scent of coffee wafting through the air. I glanced out my bedroom window. The neighborhood was lit by the first rays of the day, shining through a thin layer of gray clouds like sunshine through a stained glass window. The trees, no longer wearing their viridescent hues of spring and summer, were draped in scarlet, gold, and copper. Mesmerized, I watched the leaves falling off the trees as they gently swayed in the November wind. A sigh rose in my throat as I thought about all that was lacking that Thanksgiving day. I joined Mother in the kitchen, mildly curious about the Thanksgiving brunch she'd planned for us at an undeveloped park on the outskirts of town. Instead of busying herself cooking the usual Thanksgiving fare, Mother prepared a thermos of hot cocoa for my brothers and me, and another thermos of coffee for her and Father. This will be fun, sweetie. It'll be a Thanksgiving to remember. Wait and see. I smiled to cover my disappointment and helped Mother pack a box with the utensils she needed. A cast iron skillet, 10 plates, silverware, charcoal briquettes, matches, a spatula, and 2 wooden spoons. Dad loaded the box into his truck while my brothers and I clambered into the truck bed. He pumped the gas pedal several times until his cranky jalopy sputtered into action. On the way to the park, Dad pulled into the parking lot of a local grocery store. Through the rear windshield, I watched my parents cull through their pockets, the seat cushions, and the glove box, gathering all the loose change they could find. "This should be enough," Mother said in a thrilled voice. She scurried out of the truck and into the store. Minutes later, she emerged, smiling with 2 dozen eggs, a pound of bacon, and a small loaf of bread in her arms. Once at the park, my brothers and I bolted from the truck, frolicking in the leaves as we ran along a pathway that led to an old abandoned farmhouse tucked among some trees. While they explored the farmhouse, I sat on a log and closed my eyes, reminiscing about previous Thanksgivings and yearning for a piece of Mother's pumpkin pie topped with a dollop of whipped cream. I inhaled slowly, taking in all the crisp autumn air my lungs could hold before slowly expelling it. The smell of sizzling bacon drifted by, and in the distance I heard Dad whistling and Mother singing as they fried bacon and eggs over a crackling fire, seemingly oblivious to the fact that our grim financial situation prevented us from celebrating Thanksgiving as we always had, with turkey, dressing, and all the trimmings. "Come and get it," Mother hollered, clanging her spoon on one of the 10 plates to get our attention. We dashed toward them and sat on the ground, warming our hands on the open fire, its flames curling and swaying as they burned the dry wood. I looked at the fried eggs and bacon Mother scooped onto our 10 plates, focusing on the meager amount she'd given each of us. "Let us give thanks, for we have enough," Dad said, his face beaming. "Enough? How could this small amount of food possibly be enough?" I was irritated and wanted to snap back and complain, but resisted the urge to do so. Rather than quickly devouring my eggs and bacon as I usually did, I bit into the bacon, letting it slowly break over my tongue, relishing it as if I were eating it for the very first time. It was perfectly prepared, crispy and salty. The eggs, too, were cooked to perfection with the slightly runny yolks intact and no raw white remaining. Maybe it was the fresh air, maybe it was my dad's words, but without warning, tears misted in my eyes. These were not tears of lacking. Rather, these were tears of sheer joy in realizing that the eggs and bacon tasted better than the turkey and dressing I would have eaten if circumstances had been different. Despite my tender age, my heart softened, and the lacking I had felt vanished, replaced with love, appreciation, and thankfulness for my parents, their attitudes, and their willingness to make an ordinary Thanksgiving meal a memorable one despite their difficulties and financial woes. Mother was right. The day was a memorable one, and I remember it as if it were yesterday. Having enough that Thanksgiving was a blessing in disguise, a lesson in gratitude that to this day helps me focus on the differences between my needs and my desires. Having enough has diminished many of my life's disappointments. It has also given me grit, grace, and an overwhelming feeling of thankfulness, even in the face of my own adversities. And our next Thanksgiving story is titled, Saying the Thankfuls, and it's submitted by Audrey Korn. One Thanksgiving, I think it was 1949 or 1950, Grandpa announced that we would celebrate Thanksgiving differently. And experiment, Grandpa called it. "What's wrong with the way we always celebrate Thanksgiving?" my great-aunt Millicent asked. "Last year, you didn't like the prayer that I said before dinner," Grandpa reminded Aunt Millicent. "Your prayers are too long. A person could starve to death before you stop talking," Aunt Millicent muttered. Aunt Millicent was Grandpa's older sister. She and Grandma were the only people who dared to boss Grandpa around. "I won't say prayers today," Grandpa promised. It's Thanksgiving. Somebody has to thank the Lord for our blessings, Aunt Millicent said. We'll all offer thanks. Each person at the table will name one thing that they are thankful for. Let's start with you, Millicent. My aunt shook her head. I need time to think, Aunt Millicent said. I'll go first, 10-year-old Danny volunteered. My cousin Danny was a show-off. I'm thankful that school is closed for 4 days. I'm thankful that Grandma and Grandpa came to the United States. If they stayed in the old country, I wouldn't be here in Brooklyn, New York, to celebrate Thanksgiving. I'm thankful that the... We need to give other people a turn, Danny, Grandpa interrupted. Uncle Harold spoke next. I'm thankful that I don't have to cook the Thanksgiving dinner. I'm thankful that I don't have to eat your cooking, Aunt Anna laughed. As long as we're talking about cooking, I'm thankful that I can buy sugar and butter again. My Thanksgiving pies tasted terrible during the wartime rationing, Grandma said. Grandma's mention of the war brought a flurry of war thankfuls. I'm thankful for the GI Bill. I couldn't have paid for college without the government's help, Cousin Larry said. I'm thankful the housing shortage has eased and we have our own apartment, Cousin Gloria said. Cousin Gloria was married to Cousin Larry. I'm thankful that the post office hired me to work nights as a Christmas temporary. The money will pay the coal bill this winter, my daddy said. The grown-ups had been saying most of the thankfuls. I decided to take my turn. I'm thankful that school is closed for 4 days, I said. I already used that thankful, Cousin Danny yelled. Just because you said it doesn't mean that I can't be thankful too, I told Danny. I'm thankful for the Brooklyn Public Library. I never run out of books, Cousin Enid said. The kids in my school called Enid a bookworm. I'm thankful that the pilgrims ate turkey, not liver, Cousin Ralph declared. Cousin Danny made a gagging noise. Luckily for Danny, Grandpa pretended not to hear him. I'm thankful for my health, Uncle Leon said. My grandparents' good friends, Mr. and Mrs. O'Brien, were thankful that Grandma and Grandpa always invited them to share our Thanksgiving dinner. Aunt Edith was thankful for something, but she sobbed so hard with gratitude that I could not understand a word she said. Buddy, who was 8, was thankful that he did not have to give gifts or write thank yous at Thanksgiving. That's 2 thankfuls, Grandpa said, only 1. Cousin Danny shouted. Danny, you're not in charge, Grandpa sounded annoyed. I'm hungry. I'll be thankful when we finish the thankfuls, Great Aunt Millicent said. Well, how about the rest of you? Are you ready to eat now? Grandpa asked. There was a loud chorus of yes. I'll say a very brief thankful, then we'll eat, Grandpa promised. When Grandpa spoke, his words sounded more like a benediction than a thankful. I'm thankful to our Lord for blessing us with the freedom to gather here today. I'm thankful for Him for our abundance of good food. I'm thankful to Him for the blessings of peace and family and friends. Amen, the grown-ups said. Serving bowls and platters began to move from person to person. Suddenly, I felt something soft and warm rubbing against my legs. Grandma's cat, Miss Kitty, stared up at me with hungry, pleading eyes. I accidentally dropped a piece of turkey onto the floor. Miss Kitty snatched up her prize and quickly carried it off. If Miss Kitty could have talked, I know what her thankful would have been. And I've got one last Thanksgiving story for you, and this is submitted by Terry Elders, and it's titled, Giving Thanks for Swanky Swigs. Each November, I purchase a supply of cheese spread for stuffing celery for Thanksgiving dinner. Grocers still stock cheese spread in craft glasses and savory flavors such as olive pimento and roca blue. But now the glasses are plain without the glamorous red tulip or blue cornflower designs of my girlhood. Even so, cheese spread stuffed celery remains my favorite canapes. Grandma and Mama would chuckle at my nostalgia, just as they laughed at those glasses in their 1940s heyday and at Auntie Dorothy, who brought them to our holiday feast. Back then, as soon as we set aside the candy corn and jack-o'-lanterns in our California home, Grandma and Mama would huddle in the kitchen to conduct their annual Thanksgiving dinner debate. I'd join them in the kitchen, volunteering to peel potatoes. I'd eavesdrop as they'd bicker over venue and menu before getting down to family gossip. "It'll be at my house since I have the larger dining room," Grandma would begin. "But our house is much more accessible," Mama would counter. "I have a kitchen table for the children," Grandma would parry. Grandma always won. Never had the family gathered elsewhere, but Mama always felt obligated to put in her pitch. I'd overheard her tell Daddy that she didn't know how she'd accommodate everybody if Grandma ever actually gave in. "Now about the menu. Maybe a ham would be nice this year," Mama would venture, winking at me, encouraging me to join in the tease. "Oh, Mama, that sounds wonderful. And with pineapple garnishes?" I'd chime in. "No, we'll have turkey just as always." Grandma folded her arms, glaring at us as if we'd lost our senses. Mama nodded. "Okay, I'll bake the pumpkin pies. I'll make lemon meringue. Some of the boys don't like pumpkin." Grandma tapped her pencil on the table. "Should we ask Joe and Julia if they'd do the sweet potatoes and mashed potatoes? Joe always eats 3 times more potatoes than everybody else put together, so if they're in charge, they'll bring enough to go around." Mama and I grinned. Burly Uncle Joe could be counted on to ensure there'd be no leftover spuds. When he'd ask for his fourth helping, Aunt Julia would pass him the bowl with a big smile, proud of her trencher man spouse. "And what about Teddy?" Mama loved her bachelor stepbrother, but she knew he couldn't cook worth a whit. "Let's ask him to bring wine," Grandma said, gnawing on her pencil. "He makes plenty of dough, so we could suggest champagne." "Poor Opal can bring the green bean casserole," Grandma continued. I perked up, eager for more information. Auntie Opal always looked pale and tired, but I wasn't certain why. "Well, Opal has to look after the house and the shop and raise those kids practically on her own. It'll be a wonder if she finds the energy to open a can of onion rings," Mama observed. Grandma stared at her tablet. "I'll do the turkey, stuffing, and gravy, and you can make rolls. Dorothy will bring the celery, and she'll think she's done something special when she brings that dreadful processed cheese in those dinky little glasses." Mama snickered, but I held my breath. I loved helping Aunt Dorothy stuff the celery, and I adored the elegant flowered glasses she always gave me. On Thanksgiving Day, we gathered at Grandma's. When Auntie Dorothy arrived with her big brown bag, I hurried to her side. "Can I help you get your celery ready?" "Of course, and I've got another cheese glass for you, too." I grinned, spellbound, as she pulled the latest addition to my collection out of her sack, a rare black tulip. When I checked recently on eBay, I was astonished to learn that collectors call these humble glasses swanky swigs. They're highly regarded for their ornate decals. They now sell for what Grandma would have called a pretty penny. A set of 4 blue tulips could go as high as $20, forget-me-nots at $8 each. I wish I still had that collection. I'd love to hold the black tulip up to the sunlight. I'd recall the snap and crunch of Auntie Dorothy's celery filled with pineapple cheese spread. I'd recall how Mama poured half an inch of Teddy's bubbly into a blue tulip glass, and how I, feeling swanky indeed, had taken my first swig of champagne. I'd toast Grandma and Mama, and especially Auntie Dorothy. From the flashback fun section, originally concocted as a means to remove coal residue from wallpaper, Play-Doh was first marketed to kids in 1956 with commercials on Captain Kangaroo, Ding Dong School, and Romper Room. And the next article I have for you is titled Grandmother and Her Baby Booties. And this is submitted by Diane Fallon. My grandmother and grandfather Beam were married on June 1st, 1911. They owned a farm in northeastern North Dakota. They had 12 children, with one who died at birth. My grandmother Beam, who truly loved children, always said she was cheated out of her even dozen children. My grandparents brought up all 11 children on that farm. It wasn't always easy, especially through the dirty 30s. They loved the Lord, prayed, attended the old country church, and always gave thanks to God for all they had. God always provided, maybe not what they wanted, but what they needed to survive. When their four boys got old enough to take over the farm, my grandparents retired and moved to a small house in the nearby small town of Niagara, North Dakota. Just so you know, this town was named after Niagara Falls, New York, as the first settlers moved from that area after immigrating through Ellis Island and then relocating to North Dakota. My grandmother was very talented in both crocheting and knitting. She made socks, gloves, scarves, hats, beautiful doilies, and lace edgings on tablecloths, hankies, and towels. She especially loved to knit baby booties. She always had many on hand to give as presents. I loved to look at them neatly arranged in shirt boxes, one box filled with pink, white, yellow, and peach booties created for baby girls, and another shirt box with blue, purple, and green booties that were just perfect for little boys. My grandmother not only knit booties for her many grandchildren, but for our dolls as well. My dolls from 65-plus years ago still wear booties that were made by her with love. Back in the 1950s and 1960s, the local newspaper, Grand Forks Herald, included a weekly article listing all the newborn babies in the area, including the hospital where they were born, their sex, their date of birth, and their parents' name and address. My grandmother, with a heart for babies and children, would send a welcome baby card to each one listed in the article. She would meticulously choose a pair of her homemade booties and enclose them in the envelope with the card. Knowing my grandmother, I am sure each pair was sent off with love and a prayer that God would bless the little one who would wear those warm little booties. My grandmother received many thank you notes and cards, but there were always a few that would drive 40 to 50 miles to bring their sweet newborn baby to Niagara so my grandmother could personally see them wearing the booties she had made. My grandmother loved to visit with new parents and even hold their precious babies. I know she must have gifted hundreds of booties in her retired years. After my grandmother died in 1969, one of my oldest aunts was given charge over the old shirt boxes filled with booties. These precious booties were sparingly given out to my grandmother's many great-grandchildren, whom she would not get to meet. I know she would have loved that they received a pair of her lovely baby booties, and that thought makes me smile. Oh, how I loved my grandmother. And next, I got a short little story for you that's submitted by Bill Rugis, and it's titled, Go West, Young Man. Go West. I grew up on the south side of Chicago. In 1960, when I was 20 years old, my mom and dad moved to California. At the time, I was driving trucks for the Railway Express Agency. The relationship with my girlfriend had just broken up, and I was living in a small basement apartment. I decided it was a good time to join my parents in Los Angeles County in the city of Bell, California. After a three-day drive, I arrived in California. I was subject to the military draft, so I enlisted in the U.S. Army Reserves for 6 months. I graduated from military police school in Fort Gordon, Georgia. I returned to California and made an application to the Orange County, California Marshals Department. It was there that I became a court bailiff and was later promoted to the field to serve warrants of arrest. I once had a warrant for an 80-year-old lady in Laguna Beach for messing with trash cans. When I told her the judge wanted to see her, she took out her false teeth and said, "You can take these to the judge." Instead, I went to the courthouse to see the judge and had the warrant of arrest recalled. When I retired from the Marshals Department, my wife and I were able to travel to different places throughout the world. Time marches on, and since my wife passed away 2 years ago, I am now living my life in moderation. From Things My Parents Used to Say, Janice Graham from Mitchell, Indiana, shared her mother's strategy for avoiding conflicts with friends and neighbors. Whenever a subject came up that she might not agree with, her mother would say, "Everyone to their own opinion," said the old lady as she kissed the cow. People were so taken aback by her comment that the subject was quickly changed. Mary Perupsky shared that when she was young, her mother would say, "Always tell the truth and you won't have to remember what you said." To close out the show, here are some of the top hits of 1955. "Rock Around the Clock" by Bill Haley and his Comets. 16 Tons by Tennessee Ernie Ford. "Love is a Many Splendored Thing" by the Four Aces. "The Yellow Rose of Texas" by Mitch Miller. "The Ballad of Davy Crockett" by Bill Hayes. And "Autumn Leaves" by Roger Williams. We have run out of time for today's episode of Good Old Days. Be sure to tune in next time, and we hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Good Old Days is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. And again, that number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.